Accession number 30339, Reel 3.
Four. These were big gun tractors with 60 horsepower engines in them and winches and everything else. I had to learn to drive them. We had lectures on, first of all, how a diesel engine works and all the gears and everything worked on them. And then we had to learn to drive in Gloucester with an instructor shouting out. And you're in a cab, the engine's beside you in the cab, is one of these big with a flat nose, you know, square nose vehicles, like a London bus. Well, the engine's there sitting beside you, and the driver or the passenger's on the other side of the engine, though. It's wide, and you're high up. And he'd be shouting out and screaming at you when you're overtaking cyclists and all this sort of we did a lot of training, hill starts and stops, where they get out, put a matchbox behind the tractor wheel, and you had to take off without squashing it. Then up into the Cotswolds, Painswick Golf Course up there, the hill seemed to go up in steps like this. And these lorries, you could drive them up. What would it be? Angle of 45 degrees, like that, height of this room. And as he went up, the tail of the lorry, although it was high off the ground, you used to scrape the ground as you went up. Four-wheel drive. You'd drive up it, you reverse down it, you drive down it. When you drove down it, you had to put your feet up on the windscreen. They were amazing vehicles. And then you had to learn how to operate the winch. So then there was a quarry. It wasn't completely vertical, but very nearly vertical. And you park one lorry, put skid pans down under the front wheels to anchor it to the ground. Another one parked up, drived up behind you, and you hooked the winch rope on him. And he had to reverse over the edge of the quarry. And you had to lower him up and down the face of the quarry on the winch, do hill starts. It worked.
And with this, with a gun attached? Or
no.
This is no, just
a lorry. Just a lorry, yeah.
So now we are in the coming to the end of 42, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And so how long were you then? What did you do? How were you, your days filled there?
Well, finally I qualified and had an HGV, heavy goods vehicle license. I'd never driven anything else at that stage. And we started moving guns occasionally. Wasn't very all that often. Spent an awful lot of time in the yard cleaning the lorries and maintaining them one thing or another. Occasionally we went out on detail moving stuff. One occasion we had to go by train down to Plymouth and pick up Canadian vehicles. These were Canadian GLs or radar sets. They had their vehicle and towing a radar set as well. We had to take them up to Edinburgh. So after a few miles out from Plymouth, my vehicle came to a full stop. Everybody else went on. It sounded like fuel starvation, so I got out and took the jets out of the carburetor, and I found Hessian fibres. I thought some silly bugger has pushed a sandbag in the petrol tank to do some cleaning, and the Hessian has come off in the tank. And every few miles the vehicle would keep coming to a stop until eventually it cleared itself. We've got the Kendal.
The Kendal in the Lake District?
Yeah. It was icy. And they forgot to tell me about it, and I got part of the way up the hill and I started getting wheel spin. Well, because you've got a generator in the back of the vehicle tends to be a little bit tail heavy. So if you're in four-wheel drive and the front wheel started running light, all the drive used to go to the front wheels. What I didn't know was there was a centre differential between the front wheels and the rear wheels. And there was a diff lock on it. I didn't know about that. So I stopped. The sergeant came up and started swearing at me. And he pointed out, there's a lever underneath the dashboard, you pull it out like that, that pull on the centre lock. And she went off on the ice, just like that. Anyway, we delivered the stuff to Edinburgh. Where it went after that, I have no idea. Another occasion, that for some reason, four of us went with the Sergeant Major. Now, he doesn't normally come out with us. By train, we had to go, I can't remember where it was we had to go. But anyway, we're on cruise station at midnight, and we had to wait for, we had a long wait for the next train. The waiting room was closed, so we sat on a bench. Sergeant Major, of course, can't sit with you. He walks up and down on the platform like this with his arms behind his back. And Sergeant Major's insignia is here on his wrist. And after a little while, a red cap came in the far end of the platform. Shout, "Hey, you!" Sergeant Major didn't take any notice. He wasn't a big chap. He'd been a steel worker. And he didn't look like a Sergeant Major. He was. And he just stood there. Finally, the red cap showed us several times and Sergeant Major didn't take any notice. Finally, this bloke came running up. Sergeant Major turned around with his arms like this. "Stand your attention when you speak to a senior NCO." And him, give him the biggest bollocking you ever heard. He went off with his tail between his legs. We had to sit there quiet. We didn't dare say anything.
You were still in... So this is still a territorial... or were you now with a regular...
Well, as soon as war breaks out, you become a regular soldier.
So it's not a territorial...
You come under the same disciplines, everything.
Right.
King's rules and regulations, it's all...
And your uniform wasn't different in any way?
No.
Right.
No.
Right, okay.
Just on your records, it just says TO.
Right. But you were getting the same pay, the same conditions?
Yeah. And the 14 shillings a week.
And the regular soldiers that you met treated you as equals?
Yeah. We were treated as regulars. I mean, nobody was... We were all in it.
Right. So... Now you've gone to Kendal and you went to Edinburgh. So and you're still based, but you're still based in
Gloucester.
Gloucester.
Yeah.
So you're back in Gloucester. We're now at the end of 1942, I think.
Yeah.
What's next? Was it your visit to the States, or was that a bit later?
It's a bit later. Visit to the States was
1943.
1943. I was posted in April.
Was there anything prior to that that we should talk about?
Just that we moved guns around. There were road accidents. I've never involved any of them, but some of the accidents could have been nasty. We worked in teams of four gunners and a bombardier and a sergeant, just four tractors. We worked on our own. You didn't have a driver's mate or anything like that. And you would be given a map reference, and you would go to a gun site and pick up your guns, and you would be given another map reference, and you would take it to that map reference. And this was from one end of the country to the other. We travelled all over the place like that.
Where would you stay at night? Would you go down?
We slept and lived in the lorries. In the back of the tractor, these were... vehicles originally designed for mobile work, so they carried gun crews. There were two rows of benches in the back with Dunlopillow seat cushions. That was rather good, actually. So if you put 2 5-gallon oil drums in front of the front seat and took the cushion out of the back seat and put on that, you had a Dunlopillow bed. And you got the inspection lamp out of the locker and hung it on the rack, and that's where you slept.
And would you cook on the way? I mean, did you have little stoves with you?
When we were going to pick up guns, we usually arranged, if it was a long distance we had to travel, we usually arranged for a stop in a handiest town and found a vehicle park, went out and found fish and chips and a pint of beer or something like that. On one occasion we were lucky. I think we were going to Weston-super-Mare, because I remember this, because somebody knew where the British restaurant was. We got out a nice dinner that day. It was cottage pie, I remember that, because I had two helpings.
You had two dinners,
then. So, normally, we didn't eat. And then when you arrive at the gun site, they were supposed to feed you. Occasionally, they said, oh, you're not on our ration strength, we're not feeding you. Well, what they didn't know was, we didn't belong to any regiment, we belonged to a group, 3rd ACAC group. So the bombardier or the sergeant had a telephone number, group. Now the battery couldn't do that, they couldn't ring group headquarters. So if they actually flatly refused to feed us, he would go into their battery office and phone up group. Then the rocket would come back and they had to feed us. This happened several times. Then when the guns were in tow, if it was a long haul, you didn't stop all day. You drove all day, you didn't stop, you didn't have anything to drink or anything at all. Until if you had to stop halfway to the next base, it had to be at a military base or something like that, because of security. I was climbing up a steep hill one day. You can open up the hand throttle like that and so you can relax. I wanted to spend a penny. And in the, you sat in a chair like this, fairly high off the ground. You, in the floor there was a trap door with a gearbox like this. We climbed up this hill. It was hot there, I had the window down. And I was spending my penny down through the trap door. And the car, civilian car, pulls up beside you, winds his passenger window and shouts out, hey mate, he said, your petrol's leaking. So I stood up, doing my flat buttons up. The other thing that used to happen on hills, some of the guns weighed twice the weight of the tractor. The tractor weighed 8 ton. And there'd been a number of accidents where either someone missed a gear or their engines conked out. And the only brake you had to hold the gun was the tractor brakes, handbrake and foot brake. There were no brake on the gun. The only brake on the gun was one of these overrun ones on the drawbar, which when you're on a hill like that and you're trying to hold the gun, it didn't work. It only worked to stop you going downhill. On those occasions, things ran backwards and crashed into the vehicles coming up the hill behind them. And there'd been one or two nasty accidents. So the instructions was that we're to go up the hill one at a time. When the first one went over the top, it was your turn next. And then on another occasion, a small car pulled out in front of one of our blokes on a going downhill, I suppose. He slammed on his brakes, the gun jackknifed, it broke free, turned the lorry over, the gun went straight off down the hill and went right through a pub. We did 25,000 quid's worth of damage. Nobody was hurt. All for a baby Austin. anyway, that never happened to me.
What about your general knowledge of what was going on in the rest of the theatres of the war? Were you conscious now that at the end of 42 that things, you know, were looking slightly more rosy, that it wasn't, that things were getting better?
I wouldn't say they were getting better. It was still a very wearing time because you heard the news of various disasters from various parts of the globe, warships being sunk and the Japs chucking us out of out of Malaysia and all that sort of thing. I mean, Tobruk, that was all worrying all the time. It worried you. You know, it wasn't exactly encouragement.
So then you get your break, and you, well, I don't know if it's a break or not, but I see you've got down here privileged leave.
Oh, yeah, well, yes, privileged leave. That was a joke. one day, you, when you sign on, you're given so many days privileged leave a year, and they do stick to it. It's called privileged leave, which means they can stop it whenever they like. One day there was a rush order on, a lot of stuff had to be moved. Leave was cancelled. One of the chaps was due to go on leave the next day. So he went in the battery office and started trying to tell the sergeant major he was entitled to his leave. And the sergeant major said, "You got no bloody rights, you've only got privileges." So that was it. That's how it worked. But they were very good. Your name was always on a leave roster, so you went on leave when your name came up. They were very good about that. Same thing if you were going overseas, you got embarkation leave. Same thing when you came back, you disembarkation leave. They were very good about that.
So you got leave. So shall we move forward then to your why you went to the USA? And I don't fully understand how this all happened.
Yeah. This was on the tractor battery.
You were still in Gloucester?
Yep, still in Gloucester. One day I was told to pack my kit and give them a rail warrant to travel to a place called Holt near Sheringham in Norfolk. And I arrived at this camp, which is an anti-aircraft practice camp, but I didn't know what it was about at the time. It was all a bit mysterious. And I was assigned to a Nissen hut, and it was noticed in the Nissen hut that whenever people coming and going all the time, whenever one of them turned out to be a bit of a backroom lawyer, he was posted immediately. And I was sent to an interview with a panel of officers and asked questions like, what newspaper did I read? How did I get on with foreigners? And all that sort of thing. What's all this about? Anyway, apparently I was accepted. And then there were six of us picked out to train driving an American prime mover. That's an American gun tractor. I thought, oh, we must be running short of vehicles. And the rest of the chaps, a constant gun drill, really being pushed. Then there were long parades where you stood for hours on end without moving. You weren't allowed to move at all. And the blokes who fainted were posted. And then came the day they started kicking us out with tropical kit. And a rumour went round, oh, you're going to the States. And everybody said, oh, yes. We're straight across to fight the bloody Japs. And then another strange thing happened. They issued the old service dress. And they had a lot of servicemen who had been tailors in Civvy Street. And we were being fitted with these service dresses. And we'd give them extra kit bags. We were still puzzled.
Service dresses? What?
With the brass buttons. Tunic. Done up at the neck in the tunic. Yeah, the old service dress, like World War One.
Colour blue? Was it blue?
No, khaki.
Khaki, yeah.
Yep.
He means not battle dress.
Not battle dress, sort no, of like, not a, like a dress yeah. uniform. Yeah, okay, yeah. I understand, yeah, sure.
Well, it wasn't a dress uniform. It was the old service dress.
But it was, you know...
What the soldiers wore in the First World War.
More pucker than the ordinary...
Than the battle dress, battle yes. Dress. Yeah, yep.
So you must have twigged that something was special was happening, but rumour was flying thick and fast, I suppose.
Then we were put on a train, and we arrived at Gourock on the Clyde. Now, all the gear was loaded onto a lighter and we were ferried out to an old French liner called the Ile-de-France. Now, she'd been burnt out sometime and been re-equipped as a trooper, so she was virtually stripped inside. And we were given hammocks. They were hung sardine fashion from the bulkheads. There were cockroaches. Some of the blokes grumbled. Then we've discovered that in the bottom two decks of the ship, we've got 2,500 German Afrika Korps prisoners. Yeah, in bottom two decks.
And you were how many?
360. There were odd assortment of civilians. Civilians on the upper deck, we weren't allowed to mix with them. There were two merchant navy crews going up to pick out Liberty ships. Anyway, we sailed out from the Clyde out into the Atlantic. And they used to detail off, I forget whether it was two of us or four of us. We had to go down into the cage with the German prisoners, stripped, just shirt, shorts and gym shoes, nothing in our pockets at all. And you had to patrol on your own amongst the prisoners to see that they didn't get tampering with portholes or smoking and all sorts of things like that. I was a little bit concerned to start with, but they respected us. And I remember one chap who obviously got a bit of English, and he soon got a few of his mates around, and we got into conversation. And this was after the Americans arrived in North Africa. And his comment was, "American, nicht Soldaten." They beat us with the weight of materials. Now, they were saying that to me. Now, I got the impression we were respected as soldiers. They hadn't been graded, because normally prisoners are graded. They pick out the troubles for the officers and the baddies, one thing or another. So the ordinary German Wehrmacht soldier, a lot of them were conscripts. They weren't really any different than us. I didn't feel any animosity towards them at all. We used to let them up in batches during the day for an hour on the foredeck. Well, we had to keep them covered with machine guns. You couldn't take any chances. One night, we had to go down with the sergeant major, a squad of us. One of them was being beaten up. They claimed he'd been reading books on democracy or something. We couldn't make it out. Anyway, we got him out. And I asked him a few questions. I managed to get out of him that he came from Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. I thought he was a Sudeten Czech, one thing or another. And but he was disappointed because he thought he was going to get the freedom of the ship, instead of which he was locked up in the brig. We thought it was a ruse to get someone out. They were also convinced that they were going to be rescued by an undersea boat. One of the blokes, they were asking, you know, where were they being taken? Because obviously they wanted to know where they'd been taken. And he scratches, "Oh, it takes about 8 days to get to Archangel." Oh, it was a bit cruel, really. But the light of that, of course, every day it was getting warmer. Now, these troop ships, then, the Ile-de-France had been a blue ribbon liner. They sailed unescorted across the Atlantic, and they zigzagged every 4 minutes, changed course every 4 minutes, because it took a submarine 5 minutes to lay a torpedo. Not only did they do that, they were out of the shipping lanes, up and down the Atlantic. They didn't sail straight across. And finally, one morning, we arrived just off New York, It was mist. The skyscrapers poking above it, the steam coming out of the tops. Always remember that. And we offloaded the German prisoners at Ellis Island. Now, the rest of the American tour, I've been told that the Imperial War Machine have got most of the, I've given them most of the details, because I've got a lot of stuff on it. But what they haven't got is the photographs yet. I've got to get them copied. I'm not letting them have the originals.
No, sure. Have you been interviewed about the time, though? Have you talked to anyone about it?
No.
Well, that's what we should do, then, because that's a vital part of it. So tell me what happened. So we're now, just to recap, we're now in May 1943. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm looking at your notes. Okay.
Yeah, May 1943.
Yeah.
We arrived in New York. We docked beside the St. next to Queen Mary, I think it was. The Normandy was another dock there nearby. We offloaded on the quay side. Now, we still got some quite valuable equipment for the radar sets, replacement tubes and one thing another. And we were ordered to load that ourselves onto a lorry. That upset the American dockers. It was their job. And we were there armed with rifles and bayonets. And we were trying to keep them off. And there was a bit of a standoff for a short while, whilst they had a bit of a conflab. Finally, our people agreed to let them to load this stuff up, because we didn't want them to touch it. Anyway, it was loaded. Then we were bussed across New York somewhere to a rail siding, not in public, and we were loaded up in a train. And we travelled through the night down to Fort Bliss in North Carolina. And we were there for 6 weeks, virtually quarantined.
And what were you doing?
Endless medical inspections. I think they were worried we might bring some horrible diseases with us.
What were your impressions of America? I mean, it must have been a huge contrast between...
Oh, it was an enormous contrast.
War-torn Britain and...
Yeah,